Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Listeners everywhere all over the world. If you have a computer, you can listen to this. Welcome to La Femme de Prose, our podcast from Focus on Women magazine. I am your host, Karen Ellen. I'm talking to you from our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We begin a series today on women and addiction. We're calling it Color Her Addiction, because our accent actually is on women of color. My guest today has a lot of experience, and I'm really happy that she's agreed to share it with us. Her name is Natisha Schwaderer. She is clinical director at the Silverman Treatment Solution, which I believe is in Baltimore. Natisha?
Actually, it's in Columbia, Maryland.
It's in Columbia, Maryland. I stand corrected already. But I might just tell the viewers out there that Columbia is very close to Baltimore, about a half an hour away. And by the way, I'm a half an hour away from Columbia because I'm in the Maryland suburbs of D.C. So we are pretty close to each other, Natisha. Thank you so much for joining us. You have a heck of a job as clinical director. You are a licensed clinical alcohol and drug counselor, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Talk about, first of all, what do you do?
Okay, so since I'm the clinical supervisor, I oversee the work that my other clinicians provide to the clients that come to our facility. So that means that it entails from the moment the person walks into a clinic to receive treatment. When they come in for admissions, they go through an admissions process where they basically have to talk about their entire history from the moment of birth until the moment that they're in our clinic, their drug use history, medical history, mental health history, social and psychological history. And they provide that information to our client. They speak to our facility nurse and provide her with a lot of medical history. They speak to our facility physician, and they provide that individual with a lot of their medical history. And as they're in treatment, they vary in their length of treatment, but usually people are there for years. This is an outpatient program. So I monitor the clinical supervisor, all that stuff.
So people, this is not residential. This is outpatient. So
this is outpatient. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. But just to say, as folks know, there are a lot of rehab places that are, in fact, residential. Now, what
absolutely
is the age
well
group that you see most often coming in for treatment at your facility?
Oh, it varies. We have people as young as 19 years old all the way up to 72 years old. So it's a broad spectrum of people.
And they, I assume, come from all walks of life because we know that addiction
absolutely
does not discriminate.
Absolutely. All walks of life. I mean, there's individuals that are homeless, sleeping in tents in the woods that come to our facility. And there's people that we provide services to that make four times as much as I do in a day, and they are still coming in for treatment. Now, at our facility, we only specifically treat opioid addiction. But, of course, as you know, there's other programs that treat all types of addiction to alcohol, cocaine, you know, and then there's the co-occurring facilities as well that treat mental health and substance abuse disorders simultaneously.
Now, opioid addiction is absolutely the most famous or infamous these days, getting the most attention because it is unbelievably prevalent, especially in certain pockets of the country, some more than others, but it seems like, and that too does not discriminate, that seems to be like the biggest drug tragedy that we have these days. Would you agree to that? And where did that come from?
I definitely agree that it is a scourge right now. Where it came from, it's kind of hard to pinpoint. A lot of people have different theories about how it started. But my belief is that, you know, it started with part of it, not 100% of it, but it started with doctors wanting to treat their patients for pain. Now, a patient that's not experiencing pain is a happy patient and is happy with their services. And I still think that the medical profession and, as a result, their patients realize how potentially addictive this substance can be. Now, it just so happens with opioids. Once an individual is exposed to an opioid, their body changes and adapts to accommodate this substance in their body. And that adaption needs more and more of the substance in order to, you know, to get a certain feeling from the substance. And then it's all downhill from there because you don't want, no one wants to feel sick. So they start taking more and more of the substance in order to feel better. And it goes downhill from there. And then when they're cut off from that prescription, they get something from the street.
That's exactly what I was going to say, that it turns into, people turn into animals that they never would have been, perhaps, lying and stealing.
Yeah, they engage in behavior that they never thought they'd engage in before.
Yeah. Explain how addiction, think that it's one of those things that people can stop if they want to. Just stop taking it. Just stop. And some of people don't recognize that it's an illness. Can you talk about that sort of transition from definition?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, everyone's different, and it's not just the physical dependence on the substance that makes someone an addict. There's a spiritual, emotional, behavioral deficit that has to be there in addition to the physical dependency in order for someone to become a quote-unquote addict. I think that what happens is a person who wants to feel better eventually is willing to do any and everything in order to feel better. Because once you get that specific, the first high for the first time that you've encountered an opiate, you never get that feeling again. That's a one-time thing. But people chase after it, thinking that they can continue to get that same effect, and it doesn't happen. And it's that chasing after that first high is what causes people to engage in behavior that they wouldn't normally engage in, or to think certain ways that they wouldn't normally think, or to be accepting of doing certain things and having certain things done to them that they wouldn't normally agree to.
You just said something so important, that there is only one pure, fantastic, whatever you want to call it, high. So that it's never going to be the same, yet people in their desperation will continue to do anything, increase whatever they're on, to get to that high. And yet you will never get there because, of course, the body builds tolerance, right?
Right, exactly.
So therefore, they just keep going, and it just sounds like there's no way out. You can tell from this conversation that I do not have this problem, because I would be able to, from my gut, kind of convey this to people. But there are people out there listening who definitely already do, and I'm so sorry for them because of the path and the journey that they have to take back to making their bodies more normal. And I don't know, can you ever do that? Can you ever be completely recovered? Because that's why they say
you can recover. It's kind of like the way that I liken it to realizing that you're allergic to something. So, a few years ago, I discovered I was allergic to cilantro. Prior to this incident, I ate cilantro growing up. It wasn't a problem. It was in my food, whatever. But then all of a sudden I started having these negative reactions to eating cilantro. And at first I couldn't make the connection that this rash I was experiencing was because of what I was eating. And I rejected it. There's no way. I've always ate cilantro. This can't be a problem. And it's kind of like that denial that they talk about in recovery, that you cannot accept that your behavior is causing these negative consequences. So I was in denial. But finally, when I realized that in order for me to feel better and not have this rash, I need to stop eating cilantro, you know, then that was my level of acceptance, accepting that I have a problem. And then that meant doing something about it. That meant not cooking foods with cilantro, not purchasing cilantro, not when I go out to restaurants asking, is there cilantro in this substance? So I'm quote unquote normal now, recovered now, because I accept the fact that I can't eat cilantro. But now that my normal means, it's a different level of normal. It means that now my food does not contain that. Now I don't go to places that serve that. You know what I mean? So you make adjustments to make your life normal. And that's the same for someone who's in recovery. If they know that they have this, this is what we say in recovery, they kind of like their allergic reaction to using opiates or purchasing opiates, maybe they break out in handcuffs. So they get arrested or they get some kind of other negative consequence. So then that means that they don't go to places where, you know, opiates are offered. They don't use it. They don't engage in it. They don't deal with people who use it. You know, so their normal kind of changes. You know, maybe they have to stop spending time with certain family members. So their normal changes, and if you want to call that their new normal, then that's what it is. That's what their recovery looks like.
And that is really hard, starting off with the denial that you just meant, which is huge.
Yeah.
But then,
yeah,
you know, your body was not addicted or didn't need cilantro to get through the day. And these people, their body and their mind, I guess it's both.
Yes, it's both.
Need, right? They require this high or whatever it is, this feeling, to get through the day. Well, for example, I might get that by eating my homemade ice cream. But that's simple, even
right.
if I might be, you know, relative to drugs, addiction to sugar and things like that makes you fat, but at least...
Right, well, the only reason that your body requires it is because you developed a tolerance.
Right, okay. Now, how do you treat these folks? Because there are medications, because you're into medication management.
Absolutely.
And what do you do? Counseling and medication. Right.
Right. They're like they go hand in hand. You shouldn't have one
So medication and management. And what are some of the medications that people might turn to? Because are some of them then themselves a problem with you know, side effects, et cetera?
Okay. So what are the main medication that everybody's familiar with? I mean, it was created in the 30s, is methadone. Methadone is a full opiate, and it works on the body the same way that heroin or any other prescribed opiate would work. So that it takes the place of the other opiate, illicit opiate that the person was using, and they're getting it licitly, and they're getting a specified measured amount that's untampered. So that's a benefit because there's a health benefit because it's not tampered with. We know exactly what's in it. We know the exact amount of it. And also they're not engaging in any illegal activity to obtain it. Then there's other medications such as buprenorphine, which is an opiate agonist. So it only fills up 40% of the opiate brain receptor, so it prevents you from having withdrawal symptoms, but it doesn't get you high, quote unquote high. And drugs like Suboxone, which has buprenorphine in it and it also has naloxone in it, prevents you from using any other opiate. Any other opiate will wash right out of your body, you won't even feel anything. And there's medications like Vivitrol, which is a shot and is usually administered once a month. And it basically does the same thing. It prevents you from getting high. So there's no point in using any illicit opiates because you won't feel anything. So there's different medications out there, and I know that people have certain prejudice about medication-managed treatment, thinking that people are it's just a legal way to get high, but I've seen it work wonders for my clients who use it appropriately.
Yeah, because an appropriate use is not an addicted use. And as you said, it's not illicit. And it's prescribed,
right,
with thought
right.
by professionals.
Right. Right.
So it's a big difference. And then you, of course, you wean them off the methadone, right?
And again, that's totally up to the client. So we, the professionals, don't force a client to get off of this substance. It would be cruel. It would be like urging a diabetic patient to stop taking their insulin because now they know how to manage their diet. Well, I mean, I'm not going, you know, you wouldn't do that to someone who has diabetes. I wouldn't do that to someone who has addiction to urge them to get off this medication that's been helping them all along.
Okay, so they don't necessarily, I mean, they can stay on methadone or some other medication for years?
Yes.
Okay, good to
yes,
know. I didn't
possible.
Realize that. Is
yeah.
that,
they,
is
I mean,
that extremely common, Tisha? Is that common?
Absolutely, absolutely. We have a few clients that are on there for years, but then, you know, it, as I said, it varies from person to person. Then we have some people that come into treatment that feel that they only need to stop using their illicit substance. And once they feel confident, they ask to taper off. Now, many scientific studies have shown that the longer someone is stable on medication managed treatment, the more successful they'll be in the long term in terms of their recovery. So, you know, we encourage patients not to taper off the medication too hastily. But we also leave the option open if they feel in the future that they need to come back to treatment. Maybe they had a relapse and they didn't have it all together the first time. They're more than welcome to come back because, again, the same analogy I use with a diabetic patient. If a diabetic patient, say they go off their insulin and they're trying to follow a diabetic diet and they're exercising and doing everything they need to do to manage their diabetes, but if something happens, you wouldn't prevent them from returning to the hospital. So the same applies.
Right. Got it. Okay. Now, I know how much you enjoy doing this and helping people because that's just who you are. You've been doing this for 15 plus years.
Yes.
What are some of the influences or effects that addiction has on, for example, or reproductive health, sexually
okay.
transmitted diseases, you know, things like that.
Okay, so many of the women that I encounter in my program and in the other programs I've worked in over the years, they've used sex as a commodity either to have a place to live, you know, companionship, or as, you know, to pay for their drug of choice. And in doing so, they haven't been practicing safe sex. They maybe given birth to children that they didn't initially intend to become pregnant with. They've maybe contracted sexual diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, because they weren't engaging in protective sex. So what I've found is that many patients who initially come in for substance abuse treatment, they also come with a host of other issues such as, you know, mental health issues, homelessness, outstanding, sexually transmitted diseases. Maybe, you know, they have children in tow that they may not necessarily be providing appropriate care to because they never intended to, you know, they never went into the sex act thinking that they would be pregnant. Now they are also accompanied by a child. So many different issues that specifically women in addiction face when they enter a treatment program that comes to the forefront once their addiction to the substance is addressed. You know, it's not just...
Are women of color affected more?
I don't know if women of color are affected more, but the stigma that is accompanied by women of color and addiction is definitely have a great impact on their ability to recover and how they are able to recover. You know, it's like a common trope that, you know, here's this welfare mom, she's a woman of color, and she has like a bunch of kids, and she's addicted to something. You know, so that stigma prevents women, can prevent women from, you know, trying to break out of that mold and maybe become more independent and you know, hold a job or, you know, go back to school. It becomes an obstacle to these women. And that's what I've seen in my practice over
the
years.
That's a tragedy. That's just a tragedy. Because we know that women rule the world and should rule the world. That is no question in my mind. We have seen so much evidence of that. And for them to be, you know, society does not necessarily treat women and children all that great, but it's women of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just sad. Very, very sad.
Especially in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area, there's like very little resources to help women who have children get back up on their feet. There's very little resources for that.
That's really sad. I hope that people that are listening today know where to turn to find their resources. One thing I know that since we're on the subject, you can always call your local health department, and that will get you started in recovery in case people listening today need help. Of course, in an emergency, you'd go to the ER, call 911. But with drug abuse, there are places to call in your local health department. The other thing is, it's sad to hear that in our nation's capital in the Baltimore area, which is a big corridor, that there's not enough facilities. And then there's that other question, Keisha, how do you pay for treatment centers like yours? Those are not cheap. I mean, it must be the cycle of not finding a job, losing your job, having no insurance, having no way to pay. How do women especially get through that?
So almost all of our clients that receive services at our facility, their care is funded through medical assistance. We do have some clients that either if they have private insurance, their insurance may reimburse them for part of their care once they've paid up front. And then there's clients that just pay in cash straight outright. But you're right, it is expensive. So getting in touch with your local health department, signing up for medical assistance is like one of the first steps to help fund your care if you don't have insurance already. Or you're not, like, financially able to for yourself.
Yeah, and there's also, we didn't talk about this, but mental illness weighs in on this, too, because there are a lot of people that are not accepting help or medicating themselves, so they turn to drugs to self-medicate, and then that cycle keeps going as well, which is so sad because they often cannot accept help. Another thing I didn't mention is trafficking. I know.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because I've done a lot of shows on trafficking, and it is just so horribly prevalent everywhere you go. You just don't see it as much, but it is there. And when it comes to drug abuse, often these young women are kept in that horrible cycle of trafficking because they're drug addicted, and there's no way out often for them until they figure out somehow how to get back to their families. Or, you know, how to get the police to help them. It's just, that is a nightmare that I think is just worldwide, frankly. Do you see a lot of those?
Yes. Yes, I've had instances like that. Either a woman herself, you know, due to her life circumstances, she doesn't have the resources or the ability to leave an abusive relationship individually, or I've also encountered women who were in treatment, and they've only ended up there because it's been a generational thing where their mother or whoever their caretaker was sold them into that lifestyle for, you know, for drugs as a payment, and now they're stuck in that lifestyle. They can't get out of it because they don't have any life skills. They don't have the ability to get their own job. They don't even know basic money management skills in order to be able to get out of that lifestyle. So I've seen that happen in my experience as well.
It's very common, apparently, and it's such a tragedy. It's very, very, just a nightmare, very sad to have to say that. I wanted to mention to people about Narcan, because Narcan has become a word that we all are getting to know really well, because that is what the emergency folks use to revive drug-addicted people when they are called. And often it can, unfortunately, send them right back into addiction because they think, oh, Narcan, that solved my problem, and I can go right back to it, can certainly die of overdoses. And when Narcan is present, they are able to often, more often than not, revive them, right?
Right, that's correct. And the thinking there is that if a person is dead, you can't treat a dead person. But at least if you bring somebody back from an overdose, there's still hope that that person can seek out recovery. You know, there's a hope that that instance of almost overdosing and almost dying, you know, is maybe a wake-up call for some. You know, it shouldn't have to be, but, you know, it may be that a situation where someone realizes what they're doing is detrimental to their health. Because I really don't think that people go out to use illicit substance with the goal of dying. You know, it's a desire to ease pain. So that's what their goal is. And sometimes the consequence may be a near-death situation.
Which just tells you that they're willing to take that risk because they're so desperate to be high because they know the risk, but they just can't stop themselves. But you did also,
right.
You know.
They just don't want to deal with the pain anymore.
Right, right. That's tragic, of course, because the amount of pain that people are feeling these days it's kind of, for some, I suppose, insurmountable. Now, you can get Narcan.
Absolutely.
Just to tell people out there, tell people quickly how they can get Narcan.
Yeah, so hopefully the goal is for someone to attend like one of a training program that's offered by their local health department. But individuals can get Narcan at any pharmacy just by asking. Now there's a nationwide open prescription available at pharmacies where an individual can go to their local pharmacy and ask for it, and it's free. So hopefully once they've learned how to administer it properly, they've been able to, you know, they can obtain it for free.
That will help a lot of parents in general who know that they have an addict residing within them. And one day they wake up and that person is overdosed and they can grab their Narcan if they're, well, it's important to add there's training. So that's
right.
That's good to know. I did not know that Narcan was so available. But again, hopefully it's a wake-up call and not just permission to get back into it.
Right, exactly.
Keisha, leave us real quick with a minute, just a minute left. Why do you do this? Why do you do this kind of work, which seems endless, and the results don't seem to be overwhelmingly positive all the time? Why do you do this?
Because I think that, you know, as long as you have a living, breathing human in front of you, there's always hope. And it's, when you see those successes and when you see someone, you know, pick their lives together from the bottom that they've hit and you see that glimmer of hope, there's nothing like that. That's my high, you know, is to see someone do that and to know that you've helped them. And there's maybe a selfish reason to know that you were the individual that helped push them in that direction, because it's not all me. The work is on the individual, but to see someone be able to do that, that's the best feeling in the world. You know, that really is. That's why I do it every day. That's what I do every day.
And you're obviously good at it, and I hope that you can keep on helping as many people as possible, and I hope that we as a society can help people get off drugs. Natisha Schwaderer, thank you so much.
Ma'am.
Clinical Director of the Silverman Treatment Solution. I am Karen Allen. This is La Femme de Prose. Thanks for listening. There will be more in this series. So you all take care and have a wonderful day.